right, everybody. Hi, welcome. Please have a seat. I'm Karen Von Hippel. I'm the co-director. I'm actually the director now, as of last week, of the post-conflict reconstruction project here. I've been saying that for the last 4 years. My co-director just left. So, and we just, on behalf of CSIS and our president, John Hammery, wanted to welcome you all here to what should be a very interesting discussion. It's really going to be more of a brainstorming today than anything else. We want to talk a little bit about a report we're just releasing, which we've given you a copy of, and we're very grateful to the Compton Foundation, the Plowshares Fund, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York for supporting our work here. Today we're really going to just focus on one aspect of the report, and it's really more Justine, sorry, could you close the door, please? Thanks. It's the really the technology platforms that can be used to improve early warning and public safety in conflict zones, and we're focusing on areas where there's very limited international access and often local access. Local actors don't have a lot of freedom of movement either, so it's hard to get information out of places like the Fatah region in Pakistan, Somalia, parts of Congo, et cetera. So we're looking at these really exciting new tools and ways that they can be mashed up together to improve the way we work and the different communities that can be brought in to help with that. So what I'm going to do is ask Justine, my colleague, to briefly go through some of the conclusions from our study, and then each of the speakers will be speak for about 5 to 10 minutes and try to explain how their platforms work. And then at the end, we'll try to have really a kind of a brainstorming about how this could work in some very difficult areas. And we'll still have time for questions. We are recording this, so we should be downloading it within the next few days, so you can put it up on your websites if you're interested. So let me start out by introducing Justine Fleischner. She's a project coordinator for our project, and she's just going to briefly go through what this study was. She was our lead author on this study. Thanks. Justine?
Thanks, everyone. So I'm just going to say a few words about the study just to kind of tie what these guys are going to talk about into what we did in the report. The Homeland Security study began more broadly, looking at ways individual migrants and diaspora communities could contribute to improving public safety. Often people think about diasporas funding conflict and extremism, but they also support livelihoods and fund development projects back home. In 2008, remittances exceeded $300 billion, and migrants maintained strong ties with their fans and family back home. Hometown associations, as some of you may know, are groups of migrants from the same city, town, or region that come together to support development initiatives back home. They may fund a school, a healthcare clinic, or a farming cooperative. While the percentage of money used for collective philanthropy is relatively small, migrants are nonetheless concerned with the safety and well-being of their friends and family back home. Through this research, we began looking at ways migrants, migrant associations, and diaspora networks might partner with international organizations to utilize new tools, high-tech and low-tech, that have the capacity to address public safety needs. This formed the third section of the report, the Ideas Bank, which focuses on early warning, timely justice, and safer streets. Our speakers today will present on some of the technology platforms mentioned in our report. The early warning section discusses ways to crowdsource information about the security situation on the ground and increase reporting so that internationals and nationals alike actually know what is going on in places with limited external access. Migrants and diasporas may be able to help transmit such information, verifying facts and confirming details through their personal connections. They may also help support more citizen journalism, sharing stories about victims and issues affecting the community. Today, we have people in this room that are experts on conflict, migration, security, technology, and innovation. While we only have time to feature a few platforms here, there are many more out there and a lot of collaborative work already taking place. Hopefully today, we can bring some of this to light and discuss different applications for these platforms to improve public safety. How can we put these tools in the hands of community members and their relatives abroad who have been made vulnerable by conflict and insecurity so that they can use them in a way that is safe, anonymous, and empowering? Thanks very much, and I look forward to your ideas.
OK. Okay, thank you, Justine. So we're pulling together a couple ideas that may not obviously link up. So looking at ways diasporas and migrant communities can help, technology platforms. And don't worry too much right now about how this actually can work in practice. Let's just go straight. Everyone suspend disbelief for a while, and let's just go straight into the presentations, and then maybe hopefully it'll become a bit more obvious as we go. So I'm not going to introduce our three speakers. You all have their bio here. But what we'll do is we're going to start with Josh, or we're starting with Josh, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to start with Josh, who is at Frontline SMS, and he also runs a Frontline SMS medic. He'll explain what all of this is. Then we're going to go to Patrick here, who runs Ushahidi, which many of you have heard of. And then finally, we're going to go to Brad, who's at Pitney Bowes, and he's going to talk about how do you verify information that people put on the website that they've used at Pitney Bowes, which everyone knows makes Frankie machines, right? Okay, great. So over to you, Josh. Thanks.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm going to jump right into it. Frontline SMS is a free and open source text messaging platform that essentially lets a user coordinate large amounts of incoming and outgoing text messages. All you need for Frontline is a laptop, any operating system will do, and you either tether a mobile phone as cheap as $10, using his USB cable, or you'll attach a GSM modem if you're looking at a larger volume of text messages. So this is what an SMS hub looks like. You can do really simple things. You can manage contacts, basically see SMS like you would email, and also do little manipulations that can prove useful using keywords as triggers. So auto replies, auto forwards, auto forwarding to emails, exporting, that sort of thing. I think that the real value of the tool is that its functionality has been driven by the users. My background is in global health, and I spent the summer of 2007 at a rural hospital in Nemetete. And this particular clinic was serving about 250,000 patients spread about 100 miles in every direction. So you literally had patients walking 60, 80, 100 miles to access healthcare. And like a lot of clinics and organizations, this hospital tried to decentralize care. So they recruited basically an army of citizens, of volunteer community health workers, but it was clear that these health workers were just as disconnected as the patients were, and that they were walking 40-plus miles to deliver handwritten reports. So we basically put cell phones in the hands of the health workers, gave them solar panels, took it off the grid, and all of a sudden we had a text message network that connected these health workers to the clinicians and the clinic's resources. We saw some pretty exciting outcomes. This man sitting down he was epileptic, and he had fallen into a fire, developed a pretty bad ulcer on his left heel. His community health worker, Pascalia, was about two doors down and texted in to Alex and me. Alex is kneeling. He's on the home-based care team, and we got the one free motorcycle, a bag of drugs, and got out 60 miles to see this patient. And in about 6 months, the clinic responded to about 150 of these requests for emergency care. They had a lot of time and cost savings by shifting all of their SMS, shifting all their patient follow-up to SMS, and sort of experienced this flood of patient status updates, adherence reports, questions about drug information, that sort of thing. It was used in the 2007 Nigerian elections. A group of NGOs banded together and basically ran the first citizen election monitoring project by SMS. They received about 10,000 SMS through the election cycle, and basically were mapping Patrick will explain that. But they were charting incidents of both positive and negative incidents. People are being pressured to vote a certain way, violence, but also the good news. So they compiled a report and put together recommendations for election processes in the future. In Afghanistan, it was being used by a number of international NGOs to essentially blast out alerts to field workers. And the day that we received this report, two Red Cross workers were killed at an ambush at a fake roadblock. And I'll just read this really quickly. During a recent security alert, Frontline SMS was essential for us getting the word out quickly. Email was down, voice was spotty, but SMS still worked. We had female staff at a school near a major incident and were able to tell them to put things, to stay put until things quieted down. All my staff made it home safely today. So just a quick note that a single SMS can be pretty powerful. In Iraq, the first independent news outlet is basically using Frontline to connect to staff in the field, as well as other independent news sources to disseminate information and news stories as well. In Pakistan, during the state of emergency a couple of years back, bloggers didn't feel comfortable publishing online. So they bought a couple of cheap phones, set up frontline SMS hubs, and were exporting their stories by SMS to Bahrain, to an expat community there, where they were then blogged. And they used the there's a three-day window with SIM card registration, so you can basically be unknown for those 3 days. We've had more than 4,000 downloads through 50 countries around the world, and we now have about 1,000 people on our online community sharing best practices. And really, we're starting to see communities of practice form, and users unite. So thanks a lot for having me, and I'm looking forward to the brainstorming session.
Thanks, Josh. And I think as Josh emphasized, this is a free, I don't even know what to call it, though. It's a free platform, basically. So anyone can download it and change it and make it fit their purposes. So there's no cost incurred at all. Okay, so over to you, Patrick. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and thanks for organizing this. When we had a conference call a couple months ago, the idea of using the diaspora was quite exciting for us at Ushahidi. So just a quick show of hands just to have an idea. Anybody familiar with Ushahidi or? Okay, I can skip the basics. Thank you. No, I'll give an overview. So what we've seen over the past 10 years is an increase in user-generated content, right, from all around the world, from contexts which, there is quite a bit of constraint in terms of communicating information, but information is still coming out in multiple different ways. And, of course, most recently in Iran, the use of Twitter, use of Facebook to get information out, but also YouTube, right, and Flickr and so on and so forth played a really important role. So why am I talking about this? Well, you probably know the story of Ushahidi, right? During the post-election violence, 2007-2008, a number of Kenyan tech bloggers who realized that information was not being shared between NGOs, vital information was not being shared, and the mainstream media was somewhat constrained in what they were able to report on. And so there was a quick blog post by Ori Okolo, who had actually just escaped Nairobi and was in Joburg, and that evening after landing, she wrote up a blog post, and one of the paragraphs was, well, why can't we just start using Google Maps or Google Earth and start mapping some of this evidence, some of these human rights abuses that are going completely undocumented by other sources. So within a few days, David Kobia, who's another fellow Kenyan software developer, threw this up, and because they're very well connected in Kenya, respected bloggers and so on, they had contacts with the media and other groups, and they were trying to get the word out that there was this platform where, in a way, you could crowdsource crisis information, and not only via email or online by web forms, but also by text messaging. And, we use Frontline SMS is integrated in Ushahidi, and Ushahidi is integrated in Frontline SMS. It's a great, happy, big family. So that was the first instance. And I just want to show you a comparison that I'd done while at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. Just what I was interested in understanding was information flows during crises and how Ushahidi might or might not differ from other traditional sources or semi-traditional. So for traditional, I mean mainstream media. So what I did is looked at all mainstream media reports, broadcast, print, journalism, and so on, and hand-coded every time there was an event being reported by the mainstream media, whether it was radio transcripts that I got a hold of or TV or obviously newspaper, I would timestamp it and geocode it. Say riots happened on December 29th, it happened in Eldoret. Did the same thing for about 20 prominent Kenyan bloggers. And Kenya has Africa's most thriving blogosphere, so they were very active. They were out in Twitter, digital cameras, and what have you. And we basically looked through their blog posts, and interestingly enough, they would report on events, but it was a comment section that was really interesting because that's where the events would be updated. And so we geo-reference and timestamp that. I'll stop this or you're going to get a headache. Good. And then obviously the easiest part was Ushahidi. It was already geotagged and everything. I just threw it up on Google Earth. And what this allows you to do is get an empirical understanding of sorts about where the mainstream media reports on what events and when compared to citizen journalists and then the crowdsourcing Ushahidi approach. So three different sources. But if you look at this 20 times, which I don't recommend it, I was surprised. I was expecting more overlap. And there wasn't as much overlap between the yellow blobs, mainstream media, the blue blobs, citizen journalists, and the greens. So that's not to say that somebody's not doing their job. Quite on the contrary. It's just showing the fact that you can't be everywhere at the same time. We're talking about information ecosystem. What was particularly interesting with the citizen journalists, they would document instances of tension increasing before the mainstream media, if the mainstream media even reported on that. The mainstream media came on board when there were body counts. So from an early warning, early response perspective, that's quite interesting. On the Ushahidi end, they had most wide geographical coverage of any other source. They were a bit everywhere, and they weren't really overlapping in time and space either. So that's just to show, give you a reason why I think people find Ushahidi helpful. You can start documenting information through alternative means, through this kind of crowdsourcing approach that would otherwise go completely unreported, and obviously not just in Kenya. Since then, I mean, we were born out of the election violence in Kenya, but it's been used in really interesting ways by a number of different groups, Al Jazeera journalists in Gaza. This was more what I call bounded crowdsourcing, where people were just, you know, you had a known network of individuals who were collecting information, so the validation and vetting is not as pronounced of an issue. But then you have India or Afghanistan recently as well, where it's unbounded crowdsourcing, so you're getting information from official and non-official sources. I could get into more information or details on what we're developing, something called Swift River, which is going to be a platform that validates crowdsource information in near real time. But I wasn't planning on including it in the main presentation. But we are all talking about crowdsourcing. It's a very sexy word. Everybody wants to do a crowdsourcing platform, which is great. What we're also very interested in doing is crowd feeding. And by that, what I mean is simply if it is a crowd that's collecting this information and populating these maps, I think it's also the crowd that perhaps requires that information the most, right? If you're in Eldoret and there's a ride down your street and so on and you're texting in, you also want to know who else might be texting some information from Eldoret just to basically improve your situational awareness and your public safety so that you can make more informed decisions about what to do and what not to do. So we've added this very simple subscription feature so that individuals can go online and say, I want to know specifically when there are events related to crime, for example, in this part of Eldoret, you can specify. In the next version, you'll be able to specify the radius even more. And then you get that information. So what we're really trying to do is close that feedback loop, that we're looking at networked, sort of meshed communication as much as possible. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Okay, and now Brad is going to be our final presenter. He works at Pitney Bowes, as I mentioned, and he's been working with Bug Labs. I think some people here know what Bug Labs, open source hardware, to really develop new tools that can help verify as well information. And I don't know it'd be interesting to hear a little later from Josh and Patrick whether these things will be useful for their sites. So go ahead, Brad. Thanks.
Thank you. As Karen mentioned, we're traditionally in the franking business, so exactly why are we here? I'm going to talk to you about something that's hopefully a little more interesting than mail, and we're calling it the Secure Evidencing Platform. I'm going to go a quick overview over the platform. I'm going to talk about Bug Labs implementation that's built on top of the platform and give an example application built between us and Bug Labs. Traditionally, I don't expect people to read this. I was just going to point to the pictures. Traditionally, Pitney Bowes has done postage evidencing, as was mentioned, which is basically providing proof of payment for use of postage. And you might recognize the piece of postage down here. It's done within a mail machine, and within the mail machine, there's a security device. Inside the security device, it's like a tamper-proof device. It does cryptography. It does secure accounting. It has a secure real-time clock, and it communicates, and it's responsible for accounting and auditing that all the payment has been done for each postage that has been printed. So it communicates to our infrastructure. We have infrastructure throughout the world, which the infrastructure allows us to remotely enable or disable each of our devices in the field. If we suspect that there's fraud occurring or something like that, we can actually turn off our machines remotely. Secondly, our infrastructure is able to do reporting, feature enablement, push down new software to our devices, as well regulating authorities such as the USPS or other postage authorities are able to audit mail as it goes through as it goes through the system. So enough about mail. So if we were to expand beyond the postage evidencing platform, and if we were to think of this more generally, what we have is our two core components of what the security device, which we're calling a cryptographic and accounting module. That's the, it's a small, I have one here. This is the secure device that I was talking about. It's much smaller. The case is an off-the-shelf case, and it's hence it's much bigger, but I can actually take it apart. It's about this big, and it's in a tamper-proof enclosure, so people can't get in there and try and steal money from it. And then we have a remote data center, which maintains security and manages configuration, as well as deploys new software and downloads new funds. So we've been trying to think about opportunities for secure evidencing in different markets, such as education, utilities, healthcare, finance, and government. So our goal is to create a platform that supports the wide range of applications. We want to... All of our work in the past has been focused on postage, so we went through and we tried to generalize a lot of our equipment and our infrastructure so that we can respond to customer-centered needs quickly, as well as support new business models, such as transaction-based business models and feature enablement business models. Doing so, we want to leverage our existing equipment, including our infrastructure, and allow third-party applications to actually develop and use some of our equipment in our infrastructure. So to open it up. Which leads me to Bug Labs. And who is Bug Labs? Bug Labs, we worked with Bug Labs to test the robustness and to test out our application. To test out the secure evidencing platform. And also we worked with them to develop some applications ourselves so that we could figure out if we were doing things right, and I'll get into more details. So their value proposition is they provide hardware and software in a platform approach that helps customers easily, cheaply move from an idea to a prototype to production. So I have an example of their equipment here. If you see on the previous page, this is a picture of it, but of course, it comes in a base module, which runs an embedded version of Linux, and it's all open source, including the hardware. You can download the schematics. I must say I don't represent Bug Labs. We do research with them. I don't work for them. But and what you can do is snap on all these different modules. So if you want to come up with an application that utilizes an LCD screen, a GPS unit, and an accelerometer, you just take the module, snap it in, and you develop using their open source framework. It's built upon Java. It's pretty neat. And there's different modules as well. So as I said, it's open source hardware, software. Includes Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, 3G cell networks. It's got a touchscreen LCD, motion detector, accelerometer. It's got a camera, a video camera, GPS, and audio, different modules. So our goal was to take our secure device, which can perform secure accounting in a tamper-proof environment, and all the other authentication, all the other capabilities that I mentioned, and integrate it into a module as well. So that's what we're actively doing. I don't have it in the module right now. They're being made as we speak. So... One example application which I think connected us to this group was Bug Labs had previously presented to these two organizations, I think, in Geneva earlier this year. This leads me into the camera app example. I didn't come up with the name, but it's kind of a pun. I'll explain it in a minute. And basically, these two organizations are interested in how can you provide proof of an event of a human rights violation occurring that would stand up in court, so that someone doesn't say that picture wasn't taken there, or you know that picture didn't occur at that time, or this event, you know, someone doctored the photo. So in our camera example, it uses a CAM, which is our cryptographic and accounting module. A user would take a picture using the prototyping device. This is a camera on the front here, and in the LCD screen, they can see what they're taking a picture of. And you would install a GPS unit, and I think that's it. So when you take the picture, our cryptographic device would sign the time, would cryptographically sign the time, the date, the location, as well as the picture. And then it would store that on the device. Extensions to this, you could have this device then encrypt the image and upload it to an infrastructure, and then securely wipe it off the screen, off the device, in case you're in an environment where, you know, if you get caught with a camera with all sorts of images on it you don't want to be caught with, they'll be long gone. So here's an example. You could use, I'm not expecting people to read this again, but you could take another bug-like device and verify the images, or since it's now uploaded to an infrastructure, you can, in a web browser or whatever user interface you want to look at, download the image, and you can actually cryptographically verify again. So in this one, this in very tiny text says successfully verified and picture status unmodified. And in the metadata that's stored, that is protected and signed and stored with the image, it has latitude and longitude, as well as time and date stamp, and a couple other interesting things in here, like a sequence number. In case you're taking a sequence of pictures, you can determine if one picture seems to be missing. Here's a case where the latitude or the longitude was modified, and now cryptographically it doesn't verify anymore. So our this is just an example application, but that demonstrates both the capabilities of some of our hardware used in conjunction with some of the Bug Labs hardware. I think there's a lot more interesting applications as well. With the Secure Evidencing platform, it enables a simplified approach to security, as we've tried to generalize and put it in a very modular approach. It simplifies the design of new applications. Our infrastructure provides centralized device and key management. Like I said, we could remotely, from our infrastructure, we can send down commands into application code that's running inside these devices. It can do accounting and transaction reporting. Traditionally, we've done accounting in the form of currency, but you could think of accounting in other mechanisms. You could think of accounting as in like a number of uses or some other kind of counter-based system. And you could use us or another type of infrastructure as a trusted third party and provide verification services, which result in quicker development, better user experiences through a usable approach to security, lower cost of trial. And one thing I didn't get into is the realization of long-tail applications. That the UN Human Rights and the Human Rights Watch camera example I gave, that's traditionally not an application that Pitney Bowes would get involved with, because we'd be developing the application from the ground up. Using the platform-based approach and prototyping hardware like this, it's much easier to develop and much quicker and cheaper to develop proof-of-concept applications.
Thanks so much. Just a quick question. When will cell phones be able to use this kind of technology for photographs? I mean, in other words, you have to have that camera everywhere you go, or do you think very soon cell phones will be able to download from Bug Labs that kind of regular cell phones that have a camera, basically?
So as cool as this interface is and snapping it together, it's meant as a prototyping kind of people don't think of this as a very nice digital camera. It's meant entirely for prototyping, and Bug Labs does make some money by helping move this to a mm-hmm. productionized mm-hmm. environment. So what you would do is you would trial your application with this kind of device, mm-hmm. and if you could prove that it satisfies the need, then you could take that documented evidence and take it to mm-hmm. a cell phone manufacturer mm-hmm. And go from there.
Really interesting stuff. Okay, come on back, panel. Thanks so much. I think you guys are seeing what we're trying to get at. We're really trying to play around with mashing up different tools, being as flexible as possible in each location. Sometimes the person sending the text message wants to do it anonymously, and Josh was telling us the other day, at the moment you can't text anonymously, but there may be other ways around it. But, you know, setting up some sort of Ushahidi-like site where you can put photos, you can put voice on, people can alert about what's happening. You can maybe even provide a space for citizen journalism, because in some places we're not talking enough about the victims and we're trying to generate outrage in some of these communities. And so allowing the community itself to be writing about what's happening or texting in or even using radio to share experiences about what's happening in their own communities, I think you can do a lot. And we're even thinking of ways of, well, how can the families in other parts of the world help? Maybe they can finance, maybe they can verify, maybe diaspora communities, like Justine was mentioning, can really help to go back and forth on this. So you really want to make it as dynamic and flexible as possible. It's been a lot of fun hearing about this. Maybe what we'll do is we'll just start taking some questions and seeing, which of the speakers can answer it or other people in the room. I think we have some other good techie people here who might have some other ideas or other experiences they want to share. So when you speak, can you please go up to one of these machines and push the button and introduce yourself, because this is kind of a big crowd. All right, who's first? Yeah, please.
My name's Kevin Donovan. I'm a student at Georgetown. So as many of you guys know, that these can be used for both good or bad. And so let's take the example of the Bug Labs hardware. In Iran, you know, they took photos of the protesters and then they put them up on that line and said, help us identify these people. I could see the regime wanting to verify that these photos were at this time and at this place as well, so that, you know, if they did take them to court, you can't plausibly deny it. You know, text messages were used to incite violence in Kenya. Are there ways to nudge this technology, make the cost of bad uses higher and make the cost of good uses lower?
Great. That's a super question. Let's take a few so you guys have to take notes, okay? Did you in the back, do you have a question? Yeah. Yeah. Can you go up to Mike, please? Thanks.
Bill Rankin, State Department. Your camera, what kind of resolution does it have, and does it adapt to other kinds of photographic or optical equipment?
Okay. That's a serious question. Others? Are you guys all stunned into silence right now? Yeah, please jump in.
I'm Catherine. I work at the State Department. And I just wanted to ask a question to Brad on the secure counting device that you have. Is there a specific advantage to using that if it's embedded into mobile phones over having something like M-Pesa, which is, you know, cloud-operated mobile banking?
Also, Josh, maybe when we come back to the, you can talk about the what you were telling us about the malaria.
Sure.
Slide labs too. Okay, well, let's go to our speakers and then we'll come back for another round while you guys think of what you want to talk about. So, Josh, you go first.
Sure. So, I guess there was really one question for the whole group from Kevin. It's hard to make the cost for the bad guys higher, but it's easier to, it's, we can certainly work with the good guys to drive their costs down, and we are actively. If they're using frontline SMS and they happen to have an internet connection, basically teach them to link up with Clickatel and use an online aggregator to drive their cost of SMS down. That's a quick reply.
Do you want to explain how you do the malaria thing too?
Oh, sure.
That's also another interesting application.
Yeah, so while we're talking about imaging techniques and things, we linked up with Dr. Ojjan's group at UCLA, and they've essentially figured out how to hack a $15 camera phone to do intracellular diagnosis. So you can slide a blood sample into the back of the phone, shine an LED on that sample, and then catch what is essentially a holographic image on the CCD chip, then transmit that image by MMS, and then what will sit within Frontline is basically a pretty simple algorithm that will compare that incoming MMS to a cell library. And based on cell morphologies, you can actually shoot back a diagnosis by SMS. And the low-hanging fruit there is malaria, where we'll be shooting for HIV and TB and potentially CD4 counts. So just putting that out there.
Yeah.
I think I have three questions to answer. Start with the easiest one, the camera resolution. I'm not sure. It's not my device. But if you go to buglabs.net, you can look for all their details about their equipment. It's took the pictures that was up on the presentation there. I assume it's just a 3 megapixel. On the back, it's a USB connector. and all these devices are USB connect onto the base. The connection itself looks a little different than USB. It's just kind of it's still the USB protocol, just mapped with different pins. As for technology getting into the wrong hands, I have, since this is a cryptographic device, it has embedded cryptography in it. It is somewhat export controlled, and because of such, we kind of have to track these devices and where they go. So if they're sold in the market, we kind of keep records of where they go. In mailing machines, that's done fairly easily. We're trying to figure out exactly how we're going to do this after we start selling them, possibly in the modules. And the third question, what about security in the cloud, if I understand it correctly? One benefit of doing it this way is it works both online and offline. So inside this device, there's like memory, there's a processor, there's local storage, all within the tamper-proof environment. So going back to mailing machines, our mailing machines do secure accounting and everything while not accessing the internet. In the U.S., this may not be a problem, but in other countries where you're not always connected, sometimes you don't have the capability of accessing security capabilities in the cloud.
Great. Thanks. And Patrick, do you want to also briefly mention the Swift River thing a bit more?
Sure, I can. And just to add on the technologies, sort of what Kevin was asking, technology is just another tool, just like books were used to write to write Mein Kampf, as well as Gandhi or what have you, right? So it can be used both ways. I think there are ways to increase costs, and then for the, quote, the opponent, and to minimize costs for ourselves. They're not always direct costs, but one thing that did happen with Safaricom in Kenya during this time when some of the hate text messages were being sent out, as Safaricom was approached by some government officials, asked to shut down the cell phone network. I'm glad that Michael Joseph didn't actually react negatively to what was already a negative issue, because obviously a lot of us who were in the country at the time were very much relying on SMS to fill up credits and so on our phones. Instead, broadcasted out just calls for restraint. And also, oh, by the way, anybody who's found to be circulating this information will be prosecuted. And from what I understand, that has been going on. The prosecution has been going on. They've identified people because everybody's using Safaricom. So telcos have these people's numbers. So I think that's one way to start creating a deterrence and saying, you know, you do this, you're going to be liable. But they can definitely be both technologies of liberation and technologies of repression. And I think on the digital activism end, it's up to us to make sure that we're up to speed on tactics and strategy, as well as what technologies we can use to communicate securely in some of these repressive environments. And at the end of the day, I think it's a really important point to make that these regimes are using these technologies. But think about it. The use of crowdsourcing, the images in Tehran, where did they get that idea from in a way, right? It was coming from civil society, Ushahidi perhaps, and other groups, right? So they were reactive. They adopted the technology, but later. I think as a civil society group and digital activist group, I think we are often, more often than not, the first movers. So we get temporary advantage at a certain point, and then we can move on. So it is a cat and mouse game, and it's definitely not over. I didn't talk about Swift River.
Yeah, okay.
Should I talk about Swift River? Okay, Swift River is simply, it's going to be just like Ushahidi, which is a free and open source platform. It's a platform that will allow you to identify how truthful or how the probability that a report that you're getting is actually true. It's actually really, really simple the way it works, right? If it's just like anything else when you're gathering evidence. If I'm getting 10 different pieces of evidence from 10 different individuals, 10 witnesses, then if that corroborates, then I've got maybe a case in court, right? And all we're doing is saying, okay, if there are 10 people that I'm simplifying, but there are 10 people who are sending text messages from different phones, and they're describing more or less the same event, that's sort of 10 witnesses. Now, imagine I've got 10 tweets coming from 10 different people who describe the same image, the same event. Imagine if there are pictures on Flickr that I'm browsing or parsing and looking for tags that say Iran election violence, and then maybe the name of a neighborhood or an individual. And then I get video footage, and then I get online news. The point is simply developing a platform that aggregates that, triangulates the data, and then assigns probability scores to events that are being reported in quasi-real time. So just crowdsourcing, validating crowdsourced information in near real time.
And I think you also use solar-powered machines in places where they don't have good access to electricity, right? Both of you guys do that, don't you? Yeah, Josh.
Yeah, we've talked to a number of solar panel companies and landed on Tough Stuff, and they've basically found a great price point for us, $7 a panel. So we're actually using individual panels to take our community health worker networks off the grid.
Mm-hmm. And then Eric, who's just arrived over here in the corner, has been working with NDI to help put the Afghan election data on these open source maps. And so people can come in and look at all this exciting stuff. And he's working with, I think you're working with Ushahidi, aren't you, or Frontline?
We enjoyed talking to Ushahidi.
Yeah, so these guys are all working together in different ways. But, you know, one of their big concerns, of course, is how do you verify data? And do you want to just maybe have a quick comment about how you guys do that? Because, of course, in elections, everyone's trying to manipulate the data, right?
Yeah. So is that computer plugged in?
Yeah.
You're not online. Oh, okay. Here, let me just pull.
We can give you the password. Yeah, it's really easy to do. It's okay, just a guess.
I've got
a
connection to it, actually. So, you want to do that? First, my apologies. I'm late. So, on August 27th,
Thanks.
You're welcome.
On August 27th, it was becoming incredibly clear how messed up the Afghanistan election was starting to look. I happened to be in Pakistan at the time. NDI had me come over to actually look at the data. And what I can quickly walk through in about 2 minutes are some quick examples of actually how to visualize data. So this is what Karzai's initial victory looked like. It was a 2,500-page PDF report. As probably everybody in this room knows, this advertisement campaign is not entirely legit. And putting your data into a PDF is a suboptimal way to be transparent or efficient. So we need a data browser because passing around saying, hey, there might be an irregularity on page 1,863, column 4, line 27, was becoming really difficult with the team. What we ended up building was a web app. This is part of this. This was just internal for the team, right? Part of this is about to be opened up later this week, actually. And here's what the application actually looks like. We wanted to be able to show all 5.6 million votes and start running certain aggregates over them. So we're able to show a listing of all provinces here, and take a real quick snapshot of some of the main leaders. And I can quickly toggle over to a map view and quickly start drilling down to province, to district, and actually see the raw data for each and start cross-sectioning it. This ability to thin-slice information is essential to not just see a dot on the map, but to start seeing why it's a dot and what some of the other variables are there. So what I'd like to do is to walk through, how to handle, like, serious heavy data sets. So what we did here wasn't just take this entire site's all from only three main public data sets. We have that first PDF, which was the 2,500-page September 16th released by the Independent Election Commission, which basically gave Karzai his 54%. We have the pre-polling center list, which was about 6,700. Polling centers. What was cool there, they actually listed out estimated voters and their districts. And lastly was complaint data from the Electoral Complaint Commission, and that was aggregated down to the provincial level. All three of those documents were all public, so we're not doing, there's nothing secretive here. But to help supplement that data, we started pulling in other third-party data sets, like what percentage rural population, population per province, like help add context, right? And depending on the view, we were able to see certain discrepancies. And it wasn't like they told any particular story necessarily, but they helped add certain context for us. Now, what you've seen with these red dots on the front page is a response to a query. Basically, we built in a query tool. You'll see this highlighted stations that allows us to set a certain criteria. Let me see all polling stations that have 600 votes, or let me see all votes to a candidate over 95%. The reason 600 is kind of interesting is that that's how many ballots were issued. And this query bar actually follows me throughout the site. So you saw it on the front page of the main map, but also on my drill down levels where I'm in a province or district, I'm able to actually see the polling centers affected. And then I'm able to click on a particular center and actually see the raw votes all the way down to the ballot box. From this, we can export the data via CSV. Or print it and start communicating and marking it up. Finally, and probably piggybacking on some of the stuff Patrick was talking about in regards to maps, logistics were clearly important in this environment. You saw the initial this kind of map overlay data browser space. Well, in addition to the classic gray map, which is great for data visualization, we also made hill shades of it, and so you can start seeing the areas of the country that are extremely remote and drill down to them and start saying, hey, you know, could fraud possibly be related to actually isolated districts? Hey, if we need to send out monitors, can we get them out to some of these districts? An important point to note is when we were working on this, we didn't know when the actual runoff was going to be. And there was major concern about weather in November. Those hill shades you saw were all made by public data, specifically shuttle radar topography from the Shuttle Radar Topography Mission, which is classically called SRTM data. The neat part here is it's radar data, right? So I know how tall the mountains are. That's how we were able to theme it. So we went over and looked at FAO, and we were able to pull the wintertime snow line, which happens to drop down to 1,800 meters, and we were able to paint the country white and start identifying what polling centers could have logistical situations if the runoff was going to be held later in November, all using public open data. So the entire data browser was also built all with open source tools, specifically using Managing News, which is a version of Drupal, which people in this room might have heard from WhiteHouse.gov going Drupal. All the maps are generated using custom tiles through this system called Mapbox. So let me stop there.
Thanks, Eric. And you know, it was very important in Afghanistan. There were more donkeys carrying ballot boxes than vehicles, and so those types of maps ended up being very important. Great. Okay, panel, everybody, back up. And Eric, you float around in case you have some questions for you too. Guy. Okay. Yep. Please, and then Jennifer.
Anand Varghese, U.S. Institute of Peace, Center for Science, Technology, and Peacebuilding. I have a question for you, Brad. The infrastructure that you talked about in your flowchart, how expensive is it? How pervasive is it? I mean, where do you have it? Is it just a U.S. government or U.S.-based sort of technology? And who do you expect to have it? Do you expect NGOs, international organizations? You know, who do you think can afford it and start verifying information?
Okay, thanks. Jennifer?
Hi, Jennifer Brinkerhoff, George Washington University. I was just wondering, a lot of the applications that you guys have discussed are really about a particular point in time, and I'm very fascinated with the work that Hans Rosling has done with Gapminder, and I wonder if you've investigated any potential applications of that that technology for what you do. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Yep, in the back, jump in.
Hi, I'm Ivan Sigel from Global Voices. I'm really interested in a slightly different question about technology. That is, all of you guys, well, two of you guys come from very grassroots organizations that just saw a problem and then went ahead and developed it. And third is we have an outreach of a commercial application. And I find it really interesting that, and I know a lot of us have had this conversation before, that people who are actually working in the early warning space or in the humanitarian space don't seem to be thinking about or are kind of second or latecomers to the tools in terms of culture, in terms of the organizational culture, in terms of hierarchies, in terms of how they organize their own data. And I'm curious, as you've built these tools and brought them into the humanitarian space, what kind of reaction you've had, whether it's positive, whether you see any kind of innovation coming from within the field, or whether you see, and or not, and why.
Thank you.
Great. That's a super question, and that's part of the reason we like hosting these types of events, because we're trying to get more policymakers focused on this stuff. Please.
Hi, Whitney Stoll, Elbit Systems of America, and I'm curious if this is mainly for Patrick and Josh, but have these applications been applied to events like natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, those type of environments? Because a lot of people, you'll see an uproar of people just an overload in traffic on saying this is what happened. You'll see a lot of just overturn at one specific time. And has that happened, and what's been the outcome, and has it been effective?
Okay, great. So let's start over, I guess, with you, Patrick, this time. Unless, Eric, if you want to jump in at the end. Okay.
Great, thanks. A lot of awesome questions. So, yes, WishAid has been used in a number of different contexts. Recently in Colombia by OCHA to do an earthquake simulation because they wanted to then use it in that particular context. In the Philippines, an WishAid deployment was used to basically monitor the disaster response to the typhoons. It's been used to crowdsource peace. It's been used to wildlife conservation. It's a bit like frontline SMS. We know we're developing platforms, not solutions, meaning that these platforms can then be applied in such a way to address certain issues and hopefully provide some solutions. So they're very versatile tools in that respect. In terms of, I'll leave your question until the end because it's a pain, but the dynamic visualization is incredibly core to what we're going to be doing at Ushahidi. I mean, the whole idea is to start looking at dynamic data and visualizing crisis data dynamically over time and space. So in the next few months, we're going to be rolling out, I think it was one of the recent blog posts on Ushahidi, some innovative ways to start visualizing this data, sort of a la Hans Rosling, but specific for the kind of application that some of our partners are using Ushahidi for. So a lot of innovative ways to visualize data and to basically do visual analytics and identify underlying patterns and so on. So that's very much core. That crisis mapping component is core to what we want to do at Ushahidi. So that's definitely coming up. And then in terms of resistance to adaptation of technology in the humanitarian space, there's still large resistance. I spent 2 years trying to address some of this stuff. I think the way to go, there are pockets within different agencies that will be very interested in this. They tend to be the younger folks as well who either have already done technology stuff or are really intrigued and excited by it. There's a lot of resistance to a number of issues, but one is you have to keep in mind that you've got some folks within these IT centers, within these UN agencies and so on, who have been around for 10, 20 years, and they feel threatened. And it's not going to help to just, you know, have some new people there and say, oh, we want to use new technologies. They're going to feel threatened. They're going to simply sort of shut the show down. What we need to do is to make sure that they become completely involved in learning about these technologies, you know, send them to whatever, you know, bar camps and stuff like that, and get them to be a part of the process, because I'm sure that they can then be an instrumental ally in that respect. And then the common resistance or the common mini freakout that we get is the whole crowdsourcing. It's like, oh my God, you're just, you know, completely unvalidated information. You're going to be spreading hate crimes and so on. Unfortunately, that's a complete misconception of what Ushahidi is about and what it does and what it can't do. There's validation that's built in for people who want to use that, and it's not an efficient tool, I think, for dissemination of that kind of propaganda. You might as well just shut the system down. It costs you a lot less money to try and then game the system, you know. But I think it's largely built, and I've had some conversations with Mark Frohard from Internews about this, and we've had actually quite surreal experiences, I think. I'll speak for myself. With some humanitarian organizations, just there's a fear, but that fear is not necessarily misplaced or it's not science fiction. Obviously, these are individuals who've worked in refugee camps in the Sudan, in northern Kenya, who've had some very bad things happen while they were there because of a rumor. But nobody that I know of is thinking about using Ushahidi for a refugee camp, for example. It might happen, but I haven't heard that. And if it hasn't been applied yet, there's probably a reason. Maybe that's not the right tool. Maybe I should leave it at that. Now, what we do, we can aggregate YouTube sort of feeds and Flickr feeds and so on. So in terms of live video coverage with an Ushahidi, you could do that. You could build in, it's open source, so you could build in a feed using Quick or something and then do live reporting. That could definitely happen.
The reason I'm asking is I've been told, I haven't been to Somalia in a while, but I've been told that in Mogadishu, many companies and offices have CCTV cameras in front of their buildings, and it would be quite interesting to try to after a security incident even, to, you know, link in with some of these cameras and find out, because they're very good on cell phones, et cetera, in Somalia anyway. So let me just, before you two go, Jennifer, can I just go back to you? Because Jennifer's done some great work on diasporas, and she's coined this term, digital diasporas. And do you think, how easy do you think it would be to try to involve very disparate, diffuse diaspora groups that, you know, organize on an ad hoc basis but are very interested in their communities to start looking at these sites as groups, or maybe having these guys trying to tap in more so that they can help verify information, they can help with fundraising, or whatever it is that they need?
Thanks, Karen. I've actually been sitting here brainstorming in my own mind about all the potential applications, and I think, first of all, there would be tremendous interest. There already is, as we know from Ushahidi, I have to look at how to pronounce it, that itself was a diaspora initiative. And so I know there's a lot of interest in this. And the fact of the matter is, diaspora organizations who are mobilized around human rights issues are already using multiple platforms. And these are networked platforms where they're getting information by telephone call at the very local level and then feeding that into other forms of communication so that they can get the information to power centers that are wired. And so if we could map things like incidents of human rights abuses and assist those organizations, that would be amazing. But I think what it has to come down to is nesting these technologies so that you're capturing things like word of mouth and telephone and scaling them up to the other kinds of technologies, because there are a lot of people in remote areas who don't have access to this, but they do speak periodically, for example, with family members, or family members go and visit. And so that's where the diasporas, I think, could have a huge impact, because they could be they could export that information, which could be very, very powerful. But there are other applications that I could see as well, especially with the mapping stuff. A lot of diasporans, for example, in Somalia, they're very interested in going back and serving in some way. And the International Organization for Migration has these programs where they're trying to bring short-term skills, and they don't know where the needs are. So there's an organization in the Netherlands, a Somali diaspora organization, who goes to Somalia and identifies where the needs are, and then talks to IOM to get the funding to try to get support to get people there. So if you could kind of, if these diaspora organizations could use some of this technology to map where are the schools, where are the health clinics, where are the incidents of certain things, and then match that with databases of skilled individuals who are willing to serve, this could be amazing. Yeah. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Great. That's great. And we definitely emphasize in this report no tech through to high tech solutions. So, yeah, everything from the tea house, radio, all the way through to, you know, whatever complexity we can build. Anyway, sorry. Brad, do you want to keep going? Do you remember the questions now? Sorry.
Thank you. I think from the last round of questions, I picked up two that I might be able to help answer. One of them was directly related to me, and that was I work for a profit organization as opposed to some other people in the room here. It is true. I'm not wearing a big label. But, it's no secret, too, that we're also investigating different commercial opportunities for commercializing different areas, like in the areas I pointed out in education, healthcare, and looking for applications that Pitney Bowes can move and leverage some of our core capabilities. But also, not to put it all in that basket, because we're working with Bug Labs and we're providing the device to Bug Labs, available on the Bug Labs, soon to be available on the Bug Labs website. We're opening it up to the open source community as well, so that other people can buy it, take it down, play with it, and understand and realize their own kind of applications using our hardware and potentially using our infrastructure as well. We're still in the infancy of trying to figure out how that'll all work. But so there's two different pathways that we're looking to investigate the secure evidencing platform. I hope that answers that question. I had specific questions about the technical details of the infrastructure, where it's deployed, and how I think came from over here, and who we expect to purchase it or how much it might cost. It's currently deployed in postage evidencing in multiple countries around the world. We have our main infrastructure based in the U.S., but also in U.K. and other countries. Not every country, as you might guess, enjoys storing their data in the U.S. So, not every country in the world enjoys storing their data in the U.S., so especially some of the European countries. So we do have little remote data centers stored within the country, but they all connect back to our main data center, so we can still track our devices and push down updates as necessary. Who do we expect might buy or implement and install one of these little data centers? Basically, we're still proving this out ourselves. This is a work in process. We are developing these applications, such as the camera application, to use a generalized version of the postal infrastructure. But we do envision that there would be some organizations that would want to install like a little subset of it.
So I wanted to comment quickly on the extreme weather scenarios. Check out Raynet, R-A-I-N-E-T. You can Google Raynet and Frontline SMS, and their use cases will come up. In terms of, Ivan, to respond to your question, we've really adopted sort of a pull, not push strategy for growth, where end users are reaching out to us and pulling our technology on site and to the ground. And we really have grown from the ground up. But at the same time, I'm finding that, you know, even in conversations with senior directors here in D.C., there's some sort of unexplainable excitement in the mobile space. Maybe it is that we sort of realize that, you know, SMS is ubiquitous in low-resource settings. Or whatever it is, there is an excitement. A lot of my time is spent talking about the challenges and getting people to look at use cases first and technology second. So that's what I found.
Okay, well, we can recommend that every UN agency hires a 7-year-old to be their lead user on this.
I'm 22.
I don't mean you, though. I don't mean you. Yeah, okay, here and then there. You guys got to take advantage. We only have these guys in the room for a short period of time, so ask a lot of questions.
I'm Ariana Berengev from the U.S. Holocaust Museum. We have this mapping initiatives program there. I guess my question is a little bit about the 7-year-old. Can you talk a little bit about the demographics of the folks who are using this technology and whether you know enough about them, whether you want to know more about them, whether they're providing any feedback into the software, et cetera?
Just a couple of comments. Stacey White from the Humanitarian Futures Program. Just based on what you said, I had a question for you or for the panel about, because when I was in Tajikistan recently, actually the UNDP was matching funds that were provided by the community through diaspora working in Russia. And I just wondered if you took like the Kiva.org sort of person-to-person financing and then made that bigger financing that then international institutions could actually match. I mean, are they doing that at Kiva.org, or is it just really like you go and you basically give your $50 to one bakery in, you know, whatever place? So that's just a comment and a question if anyone knows of someone doing that. And then the other thing about the humanitarian organizations, I mean, one of the things we do at HFP is basically try to get the traditional humanitarian organizations, UN, the big NGOs, to reorient themselves to the future. And there's a couple things that happen. I think people get really excited, and you have an individual who's very excited who understands the technology and actually can talk with these people, you know, in a very competent way, but then they get stuck in a bureaucracy and a financing architecture which actually does not allow them to move forward. And I have a very specific example of an SMS technology project that we have in Tajikistan for remote communities to be able to radio broadcast amongst a certain group about rockfall or floods or whatever. And, you know, we basically had a big donor who was super excited about it. We had people on the ground ready to start the project. And then we were told, you know, well, basically our money's gone to a UN agency, and now it has to be, you know, you have to go through a whole nother application process. And that was 8 months ago. So I just think that people are excited about the technology, but I just think that the organizational sort of institutions are just, you know, really unyielding in terms of moving quickly to be able to just agilely adapt to this kind of thing.
Stacy's also here at CSIS part-time, too. she forgets. She just started. but it's a good point, and it may be that for the short term that it just doesn't exist inside the big bureaucracies, that you just go to these very agile, smaller sites that can be more flexible. Please jump in, and then you, yeah.
I'm Andrew Blum, U.S. Institute of Peace. You know, I guess I would just like to maybe counter sort of a little bit of the, you know, the view of the sort of staid UN bureaucracies just by pointing to the example of U.S. classrooms. I mean, teachers for years and years and years were saying they needed to adopt technology in their classroom, they needed to have computers. And it turned out sort of 10, 15 years later that the teachers were right in some ways, that the technology that was being offered to them was not the right technology and it wasn't what they needed. And so, you know, Josh, your map, I was on your site the other day, that map of just being able to see it's being used here, 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 and here. I mean, I think that's the most powerful thing to just say, you know, we're sort of post hype. You know, it was hype and then there was the backlash and now people are just using it. And so I think that's the way to argue about it as opposed to sort of the stereotypical kind of gray bureaucrat. And I mean, I appreciate what you said, that there is something that they know, and they've seen things go awfully wrong in the field with things that people are excited about. So just some reactions to that sort of dialogue.
There's hope. Very good. Thank you. Okay, so in the back, and then you.
Dan Henry with USAID. As one of the great bureaucrats, I should speak up a colleague here who's also great. I wanted to talk about how to bypass great bureaucrats like us. I am interested in the sort of the last mile issue, which I would maybe call the last geek issue, and how we sort of engage local technical capacity amongst enthusiasts, Linux heads, folks like that. Get them together in bar camp style environments with local NGOs. I figure you guys are closer to the ground on that kind of activity. What's going on?
Okay, and then you in the back, and then, yeah.
I'm Rachel with SAIC. to get off the bureaucratic topic, I apologize to take you off on a tangent, but I have two questions. Eric, first for you, that AfghanElections.org site that you said was specifically for your group, you mentioned that that might be made public soon. When would that be? And the other question refers to a response that was made earlier talking about identifying telephone numbers of people that were actually inputting to these platforms. How possible is that to do across the board? Is there a way to basically create a social network basis, a social network database for analysis in across any field, really?
Okay.
This is partly a comment to the Ivan.
Can you introduce yourself?
Sorry. Oh, Mark Frohart with Internews. I think Ivan's going to get points here for the most responses or questions, follow-on questions to his. Just a couple of points with regard to, I've worked in the humanitarian community and also now in media development, and I think that the first thing that in looking at that community is that it is not built to just share information other than between itself. I mean, you know, the humanitarian community has been working on information systems for the last 20 years and investing millions, if not more, just to try to communicate to itself. With regard to their perception on communicating beyond that, it's usually for fundraising. But as far as information, either specifically to the affected population, is very rare. And so there really is that hesitancy, and I think they're mostly directed towards service and service provision. That is starting to change, as several people have mentioned here, and they are starting to open up to it, first to see it as a tool to be able to communicate with on their own, with, you know, their services. But I think one of the most important things with regard to how this is going to change, and the point that we've made several times in talking to groups within the humanitarian community, is that the people that they are starting, that they provide information to, are starting to use the tools themselves. And so now you have a situation where they arrive and the refugee community, the IDP community, have cell phones. I mean, the idea of being able to talk to an IDP and then find that person 2 days later is phenomenal, but they have cell phones now. They are starting to use Ushahidi. And so the point that we often make to them is that you can wait as long as you want, but the fact is these systems are going to be in place, and whether or not you're participating, they are going to be active. And I think so now they're starting to see that. They're starting to engage.
It's happening with or without them, basically, right? Okay, the final question in this group. We'll still have time for another round.
Hi, David Abramowitz from Humanity United. I was wondering, with Eric here, perhaps we could talk about a little bit about how these tools could be used in election observation missions. Particularly, I was thinking about in the local observation missions that are funded by NDI, IRI, and others, and trying to feed real-time information into mapping what kind of incidents are occurring across the country, and then going directly to the independent election commissions or whomever to try to get those issues being addressed immediately in the six-month run-up, say, to a big election.
Okay, great. Well, we can answer that one for sure. So, Josh, why don't you start, and then I'll go just straight across.
Sure. Talk. Lots of questions. Demographics, do we hear from them? Yes, if it makes sense. But if they, you know, aren't going to be emailing, sometimes we'll get a random contact through Skype. We don't know the user, but they have a question about frontline SMS, so we'll respond. That's actually what happened in the Pakistan example that I gave. In terms of money transfer and the question about Kyiv, I think we've seen that Kyiv is a little bit more confusing than they led us to believe. But I think that there's a lot of exciting – and they recovered beautifully, by the way. But there's a lot of exciting – stuff happening with mBanking. If you take a look at Justine's report, there's a good number of examples with, you know, MVIA and what's happening with frontline SMS credit and different things. We're going to see a lot of we're going to continue to see those remittances travel and hopefully see more targeted aid as well. I forget who asked the question, but looking at sort of the whether or not we need to be approaching big donors and having them on board. Basically, we're trying to lower the barrier of entry for these tools. So really, with frontline SMS hubs, we're talking about a $200 netbook, a $100 modem, and a local SIM card, and you're up and running. So I think, you know, you don't necessarily need the agencies, but they're great if you have them. And you know, users, what we found, are going to get this up and running themselves if there isn't a lot of support anyway. In terms of the last geek and the last mile, I'd love to hear what Patrick has to say. Eric Hirschman and the group at Ushahidi, they're setting up a great sort of hub in Nairobi right now, and I think that's really exciting.
Great. Thanks. Okay,
I don't have too much to add this time around. As for demographics of who's using this technology, I'm not quite sure, as our application is still in the infancy. The founder of Bug Labs wanted to come down today, but unfortunately he had a conflict. And definitely I also might take the last mile, last geek question to him as well, because I know he's very interested in open source and community development. And as for election monitoring, I think there might be a use of secure evidencing, whether it's possibly evidencing video at a polling place or evidencing the results at the time that they went in so that they're not modified as they're en route on donkey or something along those aspects. But thanks.
Great. Yeah, lots of great questions. Demographics and users, I just joined, so I don't have all the statistics to roll out. But what often happens is we find out second or last that there's a new deployment, like in the Philippines. I found that out just by chance, in a way, that somebody had downloaded, customized it, and used it. And that, for us, is the ultimate success story. We don't want to be involved in the picture. We want to develop a tool that's open source and free and easy enough for people to go use for whatever reasons, you know, they see fit. So I think there's several dozen deployments of Ushahidi around, another several dozen in the pipeline that groups sometimes approach us and will say, we want to use this, and we'll say, go for it, you know, like, let us know if there's some tech support. More often than not, if it's a simple deployment, they just download it. We don't even have like a registration form that, you know, people are required to fill out. They can then later on come in this wiki that we have and say, by the way, I'm doing this. So we are trying to, I know that Ori and Juliana are trying to get metrics and statistics just to get a sense of what in the world is going on, right? And for the most part, a lot of the deployments and the users share this data with us in terms of the number of reports they've received, the number of numbers that are texting, for example, and so on and so forth. And it's generic metrics, but nevertheless, informative at the same time. In terms of, this resistance to technology and so on, at the same time, a couple of weeks ago, or maybe a month ago, there was this MAID, mobile aid thing that came out of Syria or Jordan, UNHCR or WFP, using text messaging for e-vouchers or something. That was pretty amazing. I didn't expect that to happen. So there are some innovative, interesting things that come out of the humanitarian sector. One approach that I'd love to take, having one foot in academia, at a grad school, the Fletcher School, where a lot of my colleagues who are graduating are going straight to places like the Sudan or what have you, Afghanistan, in fact, and Iran and so on, to basically ensure that those folks are, before they even go on their internships, right, do a mini half-day training on, let's download the Ushahidi platform, let's walk you through it. They have it, so that when they're with the UNDP in Mongolia and something comes up and they're thinking, wow, wait, we could just solve this issue right here and then, they can sort of customize it and then present it to their boss at UNDP and say, look, that becomes a lot easier to sell than if you've got young professionals that are hitting these these humanitarian organizations with some knowledge of how to use and why to use these tools. The Innovation Hub is a really great. It's been Eric's dream for a while, so it's happening now. And the idea is exactly that: is to have code, software development, innovative ICTs come out of Kenya and Africa in general. Right? We have some software developers, a few of them in Nairobi. We have another one in Ghana, in Malawi as well. So the code is being maintained and made in Africa. And there's another group called Africa out of Uganda that takes the same model. So there's a lot of innovative, very cool people in Africa who are really sharp with the ICT stuff, and they're just coming up with phenomenal stuff, and it's actually really exciting to talk with them. The elections, what Ushahidi was born out of the elections, diaspora, which is a great, really good point. I think, unfortunately, people think that crowdsourcing equals random sampling or what have you, which nobody's made that case that I know of, but I think there's this misconception that if we're going to be doing crowdsourcing of election-related violence, it's going to be statistically representative of the entire population, which is simply not the case. Nobody's making that particular case. All Ushahidi is providing is a platform that allows people to report information that may not otherwise be reported, because you've got very official ways to report information for polls, which are important, right? Because you need to have that statistical evidence, right? It's just providing context, perhaps, around some of these events that are happening. It's not meant to be like the decisive, one-source kind of, authority at all. And I don't know that anybody's making that. So I'm also thinking maybe we shouldn't even call it crowdsourcing election monitoring, but maybe just crowdsourcing during elections. Because, no, people just, I think, get confused, I think.
It's user-generated data also. I mean, it's aggregating data more than anything. One quick point before I go to Eric. I mean, even in a simple way, we've worked with a Syrian blogger here who, after the elections in Syria, he had people on the ground taking very subtle photos to prove there were no lines at the polling stations and then sending them to his blog back in the States. And so they weren't getting in trouble for doing so. But in a sense, then Brad's technology could help even verify that photograph was taken properly. So, I mean, they're just simple ways of looking at that, too, for elections. Okay, Eric.
First, when will it launch? I think that depends on the bureaucracy. It's supposed to be tomorrow. It was supposed to be today. It was supposed to be last Friday. Which brings up a very interesting life cycle of the application. Like I said, it was used originally internally. Right, and it's kind of like who are the users? We were brought over to look at a stack of data and look at possible ways to work with it and identify possible patterns. Because we were using open source tools, we were able to put our hands in the code, and over throughout the fall, during the lead up to the pre-canceled runoff, we were able to make adjustments based on what the team needed. We made this as a web app so that folks in Kabul and DC and folks in different parts, NDI folks around the world, could be able to use this together and collaborate together. So the open source part wasn't for new bling. It was our only option, right? Like, we couldn't have built this another way. And that kind of goes to the open data side too. You know, like we've got two really quality buzzwords here, but they come out after the fact. I think, but back to the bureaucracy point here. Now it's, before this part of this is going live, I think people are like, wow, this is a gorgeous mapping application, or this is that. I think these tools have very different applications and have different life cycles. So I think we're seeing that change a little from the internal app to, okay, this needs to now represent NDI. But wait, maybe it's just a data site. What does open data look like? How should you make decisions of what data should open? What if you don't even have to actually make the decision of what data you're opening and just say, no, I'm opening the data I used during the process? So these are interesting conversations I think each organization needs to have internally. But the point is, we're able to go within an organization not to sell something, basically new age anymore. These things up here are very established at this point. And quite honestly, they're becoming the only option in certain environments. Last point I wanted to touch on was the meetups. Landed in Pakistan, had a Drupal meetup. DAI was there. Amazing capacity building potentials. Holbrook would be stoked. I'm being serious. I mean, look at this. We're talking about intranets and tracking applications and mapping applications. They're all done with open source software. Like, traditionally during a life cycle of a development project, this would be considered waste. But what if it could actually be supported by locals on the ground, these tools then be used for other for-profit activities? The actual process of supporting the development initiative can actually be a development push in itself and generate capacity wins and be a sustainability win because it's open source.
And by the way, I was out in Kabul with NDI for the elections, and they provided cell phones to the Afghan monitors who were going throughout the country. I don't know, though, if you were able to put the photos that they were taking up on that site, though. Or no?
No. This is just, so the other cool thing, because it's open source, no licensing, there's an internal version that has a totally different set of data on it. Like, this ability to clone and start morphing. So some of NDI's private data is up on a private site.
Because that's a great way of deterring fraud, too, just what we were talking about. Okay, a few more questions, and then I think we're going to end a teeny bit early so people can mill around and attack all these guys. So you over there, and then I'll come back to you.
Hello, Adam Kaplan, also with USAID's Office of Transition Initiatives. I work in media development. Other than the frontline SMS, what you're largely talking about is information coming into a centralized hub and is then viewable by people with web access. Information is really only power if it's in the hands of everybody. Can you talk a little bit about how you get access or how you might get access to this information if your access point is a dumb phone?
They can do that one. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
It's actually two questions. I was wondering, Eric, if you could flesh out the open data a little more, and if you have all the data you need for doing stuff like that, and if you don't, who's sitting on it, and, why, or if the movement is, in the right trajectory. And then secondly, as soon as I'm hearing this open hardware stuff, and I think development, we can build local capacity for manufacturers because they have the schematics, as we've seen with software, and this is kind of the next step. But then you mentioned the export controls. So I was wondering, since we have U.S. government official people here, can we talk a little bit about how export controls might make it so that only the governments, the Iranian regime can already do this cryptography? Are we really locking out the grassroots level stuff by having these export controls?
Okay, yep, go ahead.
Sorry, you guys forgot my last question on the last round. The SNA, the social network identification abilities, capabilities.
Great.
Can you talk to that a little bit?
Sure. And also just one point for other people to look. There's a lot of great innovations in healthcare. I don't know if people know about patientslikeme.com, but this is user-generated data. Users join disease communities, and then they help each other out and provide information. And it's really been able to accelerate a lot of really exciting things in healthcare just by users putting information into this site. So have a look at that, too, as another one. Go ahead, Josh.
Sure. So to answer your question, Well, I guess it wasn't really directed at me, but I'll comment. We really did, or Ken Banks really did build Frontline SMS for grassroots NGOs, like I said. And you know, you don't need the internet to run it. You need to get the download link somehow, either you know, access at an internet cafe or you know, someone brings in a USB drive. But you know, once you have Frontline running, you don't need the internet. You know, so that's great, and we really do focus on, and I get really excited about local data, local information, local knowledge, and then finally local action, right? And especially in healthcare, talking about hospital systems, that's where I get really, really pumped. But you know, when you do have access to the internet, and Usha Edie and others can speak to this, you're able to visualize, aggregate data, and you have the remote access. That's extremely powerful, but you get it when you have the net. So that's, in a sense, a luxury in some places, but it's ever expanding. So anyway, that's the comment there. Social network IDs, I'm really not sure, to be perfectly honest. Okay. Sorry.
Good answer.
I didn't forget your question either. I just didn't have any comment on it at the time. I do apologize. As for the online and offline question about beyond web capabilities, well, my technology I talked about is more about capturing information. One of the capabilities, as I alluded to earlier, is that by including security down in the device, and there's like a battery in here that lasts 7 years, it can work offline, and you could like possibly sync whatever kind of device or application that you're using once a week and upload data or on whatever frequency you need. So some of these solutions could easily work offline and online. That doesn't help the display of information, which there's just lots of other experts that might talk about it further. The hard question about the export controls that was easily directed at me. I don't believe there's any export controls around just the core device itself. And what I alluded to before, I'm going to give a very bland answer to that because I'm sure there's people in this room that know the rules a lot more than I do, and I know that we do have an export control department in our company. But it depends on how you use the device. If it's only for digitally signing and not for encrypting, then there's some levels and some rules. But if you're using it for encrypting and providing confidentiality, there's some different rules. Again, I'm not a lawyer, disclaimer. But we have our devices installed in many countries around the world. I don't think we have any in Iran, per se, but I'm sure we don't. But I do believe it's just a hurdle that must be gone through with the proper documentation and going through the proper bureaucracy and flowcharts. Okay. Not a very good answer. But.
I think we're talking a lot about photographic evidence and secure communication. So a colleague of ours, Nathan Freitas, has been developing this Guardian platform for the Android phone, which is supposed to be the fortress kind of phone for digital activists to be, fully encrypted, password protected, secure communication, picture encryption, and so on and so forth. We're all twiddling our thumbs and waiting until he's finished because many of us around the world who are involved in one way or another in digital activism and training digital activists think this could be a very good tool. That's just because we've talked a lot about photographic evidence, and we have an Ushahidi app for the Android as well, which we can then make secure. In terms of getting the information and then getting it back to those who need it the most, one thing that I was trying to get across in the presentation was, Ushahidi is developing these platforms for crowdsourcing information, but we're also providing these subscription features which allow, so the crowd feeding goes right back to the individuals, anybody who really wants to be alerted by, crime, election violence, or what have you. So it does go right back, and that's what I think also the point or part of what the genesis of Ushahidi was about was that nobody was sharing information. The people on the ground didn't have information, and that was just not okay. We've been, as I mentioned earlier as well, working very closely with Frontline SMS so that the next version, of Frontline and Ushahidi, but Frontline is very exciting because they're going to be including an Ushahidi tab within the Frontline interface, which you could then use offline. And I just heard about this morning from Eric, actually. I had no idea. That's incredibly exciting that you can start now collecting that information without needing anything, you know, in terms of wireless or internet access, and then later having that data, putting it on the frontline Ushahidi page right there integrated with everything else is going to be really, really exciting. I didn't hear the entire question for social network analysis.
Basically, what I'm asking is if you can identify, say there's one person that every day is putting something on your database or on your platform, can you identify that one person and by either their geocords or their telephone identifier, or is there a way of identifying the personalities that are adding on to your platform by location or associations?
And then putting the predator
Well, I mean,
I wasn't going there. You said that.
You can tell me about that. You know, if people text in information, the text number, the phone numbers are there, in part because then you can text them back and say, could you give us more information on where this actually happened, how many people were injured, or what have you. So you could do that.
Are
those records kept? So another easy confusion is, our group is called Ushahidi, and the platform we're developing is called Ushahidi. So everybody thinks we're deploying these platforms when that's not, in fact, the case. So that depends on partners, from Internews or others, the UN in Colombia. That's an ethical issue, and it's not one that we necessarily have control over, but it's one we've actually been discussing about potentially putting some guidelines, codes of conduct, in terms of, you know, how you should treat this information. We are, in the next version that's coming out, allowing people to also report anonymously so that that information doesn't get kept and it's confidential and so on.
Also, we talked last week with Ken and Josh about maybe reverse charging for text messages for people that just don't have a lot of money but want to be able to feed in information. And even though the costs themselves are small, there might be ways of even doing that.
Well, we use short codes, right, for text messaging, so it can be completely free to folks who are texting in. That's another way to try and get more and more information from it.
The reason why I asked
very useful in identifying different tribal motivations or regional motivations or cultural societal motivations that might gear one group into doing one thing or another, and just identifying social and cultural trends. And that's really what we're looking at doing.
You could probably just look at the maps as well, though, and see what you can learn from reading the bubbles and things. Okay, so Eric, and then I'll come to you. Okay.
Let's talk about the offline situation. This is really cool. And I'll just speak up because I'm not on mic. These maps, they're made with tiles. Everybody use Google Maps. You know when you zoom in, you see the little squares load? These are tiles. What's really a tile? It's just an image, right? Well, check this out. This is just JavaScript, which means it doesn't have a lot of moving parts. It'll just sit in like a little HTML page. And this tool here is an open source JavaScript library called OpenLayers. OpenLayers takes all this huge stack of tiles and organizes them and lines them up to actually make the map. Now we have no moving parts, right? No servers, nothing. So we could run this off a USB drive. You can take your tiles that you generate, put them on a USB drive, rework open layers a little, and actually point it at a local tile set. So now you can have something 10 times faster than Google Earth is in Washington in a place where there's no electricity and no internet connection. And on top of that, you can make it useful for people because they can then upload KML, whether that's from their device or from their data space. You know, KML is easy to generate, and just put it on top of these maps. So some of the future of offline mapping is possibly dead simple, and is exciting. And a lot of that is thanks to USB sticks becoming much cheaper and much larger. Being able to buy a 16 gig drive and getting that under $50 is pretty powerful. So there's going to be a report out next week with an original or initial alpha code, and then it's going to go shopping for a funding request. But it's more about a concept than an actual code.
We can refit the predators to drop USB sticks.
There you go. Carpet USB sticks. Lastly, you know, in regards to the direction of open data, so this is like a DC political thing right now. So you got a lot of people talking about transparency and all that. That's really hard for actual decision makers that need to allocate resources to opening data when they actually still have, you know, an entire program to run. And it's like, well, you know, who do I know is going to use my data, and like, how is it going to be, all this stuff. The reality is opening data and having your data in a flexible format actually makes your team more efficient. I mean, that's what we did with partnering with NDI.
So if organizations start focusing on using standards and opening data up internally during the application, these M&E tools actually start becoming living and being used throughout the process, which is very exciting in regards to how you can justify the expense of building some of these. It will actually make your application, your actual program more effective. You'll be able to deliver more. And as a nice byproduct, you might be more transparent. You can open up the data, as NDI is able to do so easily later this week, and have positive externalities through opening up that data. I think it's going to take another 12 months of the open data honeymoon to run its course before people start asking, what's the decision-making paradigm for opening up data? But really, it's going to come down to, let's make this part of the process. It's going to immediately generate and pay for itself within a matter of weeks, and then the rest is gravy.
Yep, as we say, free revealing makes economic sense. So that's one of our cliches. Go ahead, please, jump in.
I just want to have a quick comment on the ethics of data collection.
Can you use the mic?
Evan Siegel from Global Voices. Sorry. So I was on a panel with Eric Hersman of Ushahidi a few weeks ago, and he said that actually Ushahidi's default position is that you make users anonymous and you wipe the data when you're done. And one of the reasons for that is I think the underlying ethical position behind it is that when people engage your platform, they have a right to know how the data that you take from them is going to be used, and that helps them make a decision about how or whether they will participate in what it is that you're trying to do. So whether or not you collect data on them is one thing, but it's really important, I think, from an ethical standpoint, to be really transparent about how you intend to use the data, mm-hmm. whether your tool is about circumvention technology, whether your tool is about mapping, whether it's about identifying a case. There's a basic security issue for the people involved, and some of the secondary research questions about whether there's a language group or an ethnic group or a religious group about it tend to be subsumed under the very basic question of security and autonomy for the user who decides that he or she will participate in the platform. So I think that if you wanted to do crowdsourcing in any kind of comprehensive way that's trustworthy, you have to start with that position.
Right, and that's the biggest challenge in new environments is to make sure people realize that it's okay to put their data in because they're going to be very paranoid if they've never done it before. And that's, somewhere like Fatah region, which hasn't been tried before. That would be one of the biggest challenges. I'm going to end this now because I know a few of you want to talk to our speakers. And just please join me in thanking all of them for a really rich discussion today.